predictions. Those with a 0.1% quantum probability or a 0.001% quantum probability or a 0.000001% quantum probability are indeed rare. And that's why garden variety multiverse inhabitants like us don't find ourselves living inside one of them. With an infinite number of universes, the optimist concludes, the deep truth must be that the rarity of anomalous universes in some yet-to-be-established manner still holds. The expectation is that we will one day derive a measure, a definite means for comparing the various infinite collections of universes, and that those universes emerging from rare quantum aberrations will have a tiny measure compared with those emerging from the likely quantum outcomes. To accomplish this remains an immense challenge, but the majority of researchers in the field are convinced that the agreement between theory and data must mean that we will one day succeed. Mysteries and multiverses. Can a multiverse provide explanatory power of which we'd otherwise be deprived? No doubt you've noticed that even the most sanguine projections suggest that predictions emerging from a multiverse framework will have a different character from those we traditionally expect from physics. The precession of the perihelion of Mercury, the magnetic dipole moment of the electron, the energy released when a nucleus of uranium splits into barium and krypton. These are predictions. They result from detailed mathematical calculations based on solid physical theory and produce precise, testable numbers. And the numbers have been verified experimentally. For example, calculations establish that the electron's magnetic moment is 2.00231930436 28. Measurements reveal it to be 2.00231930436 22. Within the tiny margins of error inherent to each, experiment thus confirms theory to better than one part in 10 billion. From where we now stand, it seems that multiverse predictions will never reach this standard of precision. In the most refined scenarios, we might be able to predict that it's highly likely that the cosmological constant, or the strength of the electromagnetic force, or the mass of the up quark, lies within some range of values. But to do better, we'll need extraordinarily good fortune. In addition to solving the measure problem, we'll need to discover a convincing multiverse theory with profoundly skewed probabilities, such as 99.9999% probability that an observer will find himself in a universe with a cosmological constant equal to the value we measure, or astonishingly tight correlations, such as that electrons exist only in universes with a cosmological constant equal to 10^-123. If a multiverse proposal doesn't have such favorable features, it will lack the precision that, for so long, has distinguished physics from other disciplines. To some researchers, that's an unacceptable price to pay. For quite a while, I took that position too, but my view has gradually shifted. Like every other physicist, I prefer sharp, precise, and unequivocal predictions. But I and many others have come to realize that although some fundamental features of the universe are suited for such precise mathematical predictions, others are not, or at the very least, it's logically possible that there may be features that stand beyond precise predictions. From the mid-1980s, when I was a young graduate student working on string theory, there was broad expectation that the theory would one day explain the values of particle masses, force strengths, the number of spatial dimensions, and just about every other fundamental physical feature. I remain hopeful that this is a goal we will one day reach. But I also recognize that it is a tall order for a theory's equations to churn away and produce a number like the electron's mass, about 10^-22 in units of the Planck mass, or the top quark's mass, about 10^-17 in units of the Planck mass. And when it comes to the cosmological constant, the challenge appears Herculean. A calculation that, after pages of manipulations and megawatts of computer crunching, results in the very number that we encountered at the start of Chapter 6 Well, it's not impossible, but it does strain even the optimist's optimism. Certainly, string theory seems no closer to calculating any of these numbers today than it did when I first started working on it. This doesn't mean that it or some future theory won't one day succeed. Maybe the optimist needs to be yet more imaginative. But given the physics of today, it makes sense to consider new approaches. That's what the multiverse does. In a well-developed multiverse proposal, there's a clear delineation of the physical features that need to be approached differently from standard practice, those features that vary from universe to universe. And that's the power of the approach. What you can absolutely count on from a multiverse theory is a sharp vetting of which single universe mysteries persist in the many universe setting and which do not. The cosmological constant is a prime example. If the cosmological constant's value varies across a given multiverse and does so in sufficiently fine increments, what was once mysterious, its value, would now be prosaic. Just as a well-stocked shoe store surely has your shoe size, an expansive multiverse surely has universes with the value of the cosmological constant we've measured. What generations of scientists might have struggled valiantly to explain, the multiverse would have explained away. The multiverse would have shown that a seemingly deep and perplexing issue emerged from the misguided assumption that the cosmological constant has a unique value. It is in this sense that a multiverse theory has the capacity to offer significant explanatory power, and it has the potential to profoundly influence the course of scientific inquiry. Such reasoning must be wielded with care. What if Newton, after the apple fell, reasoned that we're part of a multiverse in which apples fall down in some universes, up in others, and so the falling apple simply tells us which kind of universe we inhabit with no need for further investigation? Or what if he concluded that in each universe some apples fall down, while others fall up? And the reason we see the falling down variety is simply the environmental fact that in our universe, apples that fall up have already done so and have thus long since departed for deep space. This is a fatuous example, of course. There's never been any reason, theoretical or otherwise, for such thinking. But the point is serious. By invoking a multiverse, science could weaken the impetus to clarify particular mysteries, even though some of those mysteries might be ripe for standard, non-multiverse explanations. When all that was really called for was harder work and deeper thinking, we might instead fail to resist the lure of multiverse temptation and prematurely abandon conventional approaches. This potential danger explains why some scientists shudder at multiverse reasoning. It's why a multiverse proposal that's taken seriously needs to be strongly motivated from theoretical results, and it must articulate with precision the universes of which it's composed. We must tread carefully and systematically. But to turn away from a multiverse because it could lead us down a blind alley is equally dangerous. In doing so, we might well be turning a blind eye to reality. Chapter 8. The Many Worlds of Quantum Measurement. The Quantum Multiverse. The most reasonable assessment of the parallel universe theories we've so far encountered is that the jury is out. An infinite spatial expanse, eternal inflation, brain worlds, cyclical cosmology, string theory's landscape. These intriguing ideas have emerged from a range of scientific developments, but each remains tentative, as do the multiverse proposals each has spawned. While many physicists are willing to offer their opinions, pro and con, regarding these multiverse schemes, most recognize that future insights, theoretical, experimental, and observational, will determine whether any become part of the scientific canon. The multiverse we'll now take up, emerging from quantum mechanics, is viewed very differently. Many physicists have already reached a final verdict on this particular multiverse. The thing is, they haven't all reached the same verdict. The differences come down to the deep and as yet unresolved problem of navigating from the probabilistic framework of quantum mechanics to the definite reality of common experience. Quantum reality. In 1954, nearly 30 years after the foundations of quantum theory had been set down by luminaries like Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and Erwin Schrödinger, an unknown graduate student from Princeton University named Hugh Everett III came to a startling realization. His analysis, which focused on a gaping hole that Bohr, the grand master of quantum mechanics, had danced around but failed to fill, revealed that a proper understanding of the theory might require a vast network of parallel universes. Everett was one of the earliest mathematically motivated insights suggesting that we might be part of a multiverse. Everett's approach, which in time would be called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, has had a checkered history. In January 1956, having worked out the mathematical consequences of his new proposal, Everett submitted a draft of his thesis to John Wheeler, his doctoral advisor. Wheeler, one of 20th century physics' most celebrated thinkers, was thoroughly impressed. But that May, when Wheeler visited Bohr in Copenhagen and discussed Everett's ideas, the reception was icy. Bohr and his followers had spent decades refining their view of quantum mechanics. To them, the questions Everett raised and the outlandish ways in which he thought they should be addressed were of little merit. Wheeler held Bohr in the highest regard, and so placed particular value on appeasing his elder colleague. In response to the criticisms, Wheeler delayed granting Everett his PhD and compelled him to modify the thesis substantially. Everett was to cut out those parts blatantly critical of Bohr's methodology and emphasize that his results were meant to clarify and extend the conventional formulation of quantum theory. Everett resisted, but he had already accepted a job in the Defense Department that required a doctorate, so he reluctantly acquiesced. In March of 1957, Everett submitted a substantially trimmed-down version of his original thesis. By April, it was accepted by Princeton as fulfilling his remaining requirements, and in July, it was published in the Reviews of Modern Physics. But with Everett's approach to quantum theory having already been dismissed by Bohr and his entourage, and with the muting of the grander vision articulated in the original thesis, the paper was ignored. 10 years later, the renowned physicist Bryce DeWitt plucked Everett's work from obscurity. DeWitt, who was inspired by the results of his graduate student, Neil Graham, that further developed Everett's mathematics, became a vocal proponent of the Everettian rethinking of quantum theory. Besides publishing a number of technical papers that brought Everett's insights to a small but influential community of specialists, in 1970, DeWitt wrote a general-level summary for Physics Today that reached a much broader scientific audience. And unlike Everett's 1957 paper, which shied away from talk of other worlds, DeWitt underscored this feature, highlighting it with an unusually candid reflection regarding his shock on learning Everett's conclusion that we are part of an enormous multi-world. The article generated a significant response in a physics community that had become more receptive to tampering with orthodox quantum ideology and ignited a debate still going on that concerns the nature of reality when, as we believe they do, quantum laws hold sway. Let me set the stage. The upheaval in understanding that took place between roughly 1900 and 1930 resulted in a ferocious assault on intuition, common sense, and the well-accepted laws that the new vanguard soon began calling classical physics, a term that carries the weight and respect given to a picture of reality that is at once venerable, immediate, satisfying, and predictive. Tell me how things are now, and I'll use the laws of classical physics to predict how things will be at any moment in the future or how they were at any moment in the past. Subtleties such as chaos, in the technical sense, slight changes in how things are now can result in huge errors in the predictions. and the complexity of the equations challenge the practicality of this program in all but the simplest situations. But the laws themselves are unwavering in their vice-like grip on a definitive past and future. The quantum revolution required that we give up the classical perspective because new results established that it was demonstrably wrong. For the motion of big objects like the Earth and the Moon, or of everyday objects like rocks and balls, the classical laws do a fine job of prediction and description. But pass into the microworld of molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles, and the classical laws fail. In contradiction of the very heart of classical reasoning, if you run identical experiments on identical particles that have been set up identically, you will generally not get identical results. Imagine, for example, that you have 100 identical boxes, each containing one electron set up according to an identical laboratory procedure. After exactly 10 minutes, you and 99 cohorts measure the positions of each of the 100 electrons. Despite what Newton, Maxwell, or even a young Einstein would have anticipated, would likely have been willing to bet their lives on, the 100 measurements won't yield the same result. In fact, at first blush, the results will look random, with some electrons found near their box's front lower left corner, some near the back upper right, some around the middle, and so on. The regularities and patterns that make physics a rigorous and predictive discipline become apparent only if you run this same experiment with 100 boxed electrons over and over again. Were you to do so, here's what you'd find. If your first batch of 100 measurements found 27% of the electrons near the lower left corner, 48% near the upper right, and 25% near the middle, then the second batch will yield a very similar distribution. So will the third batch, the fourth, and those that follow. The regularity, therefore, isn't evident in any single measurement. You can't predict where any given electron will be. Instead, the regularity is found in the statistical distribution of many measurements. The regularity, that is, speaks to the likelihood or probability of finding an electron at any particular location. The breathtaking achievement of quantum mechanics founders was to develop a mathematical formalism that dispensed with the absolute predictions intrinsic to classical physics and instead predicted such probabilities. Working from an equation Schrödinger published in 1926 and an equivalent, though somewhat more awkward, equation Heisenberg wrote down in 1925, physicists can input the details of how things are now and then calculate the probability that they will be one way or another still, at any moment in the future. But don't be misled by the simplicity of my little electron example. Quantum mechanics applies not just to electrons, but to all types of particles. And it tells us not only about their positions, but also their velocities, their angular momenta, their energies, and how they behave in a wide range of situations, from the barrage of neutrinos now wafting through your body to the frenzied atomic fusions taking place in the cores of distant stars. Across such a broad sweep, the probabilistic predictions of quantum mechanics match experimental data. Always. In the more than 80 years since these ideas were developed, there has not been a single verifiable experiment or astrophysical observation whose results conflict with quantum mechanical predictions. For a generation of physicists to have confronted such a radical departure from the intuitions formed out of thousands of years of collective experience, and in response to have recast reality within a wholly new framework based on probabilities, is a virtually unmatched intellectual achievement. Yet, one uncomfortable detail has been hovering over quantum mechanics since its inception, a detail that eventually opened a pathway to parallel universes. To understand it, we need to look a little more closely at the quantum formalism. The puzzle of alternatives. In April 1925, during an experiment at Bell Labs undertaken by two American physicists, Clinton Davison, and Lester Germer. A glass tube containing a hot chunk of nickel suddenly exploded. Davison and Germer had been spending their days firing beams of electrons at specimens of nickel to investigate various aspects of the metal's atomic properties. The equipment failure was a nuisance, albeit one all too familiar in experimental work. On cleaning up the glass shards, Davison and Germer noticed that the nickel had been tarnished during the explosion. Not a big deal, of course. All they had to do was heat the sample, vaporize the contaminant, and start again. And so they did. But that choice, to clean the sample instead of opting for a new one, proved fortuitous. When they directed the electron beam at the newly cleaned nickel, the results were completely different from any they or anyone else had ever encountered. By 1927, it was clear that Davison and Germer had established a vital feature of the rapidly developing quantum theory, and within a decade, their serendipitous discovery would be honored with the Nobel Prize. Although Davison and Germer's demonstration predates talking movies and the Great Depression, it's still the most widely used method for introducing quantum theory's essential ideas. Here's how to think about it. When Davison and Germer heated the tarnished sample, they caused numerous small nickel crystals to meld into fewer, larger ones. In turn, their electron beam no longer reflected off a highly uniform surface of nickel, but instead bounced back from a few concentrated locations where the larger nickel crystals were centered. A simplified version of their experiment, in which electrons are fired at a barrier containing two narrow slits, highlights the essential physics. Electrons emanating from one slit or the other are like electrons bouncing back from one nickel crystal or its neighbor. Modeled in this way, Davison and Germer were carrying out the first version of what's now called the double slit experiment. To grasp Davison and Germer's startling result, imagine closing off either the left or the right slit and capturing the electrons that pass through one by one on a detector screen. After many such electrons are fired, the detector screens will show bunches of electrons aligned with either the left or the right slit. A rational, non-quantum trained mind would therefore expect that when both slits are open, the data would be an amalgam of these two results. But the astounding fact is that this is not what happens. Instead, the data Davison and Germer found was a sequence of light and dark bands indicating a series of positions where electrons do and do not land. These results deviate from expectations in a way that's particularly peculiar. The dark bands are locations where electrons are copiously detected if only the left slit or only the right slit is open, but which are apparently unreachable when both slits are available. The presence of the left slit thus changes the possible landing locations of electrons passing through the right slit and vice versa, which is thoroughly perplexing. On the scale of a tiny particle like an electron, the distance between the slits is huge. So when the electron passes through one slit, how could the presence or absence of the other have any effect, let alone the dramatic influence evident in the data? It's as if for many years you happily enter an office building using one door, but when the management finally adds a second door on the building's other side, you can no longer reach your office. What are we to make of this? The double slit experiment leads us inescapably to a conclusion hard to fathom. Regardless of which slit it passes through, each individual electron somehow knows about both. There's something associated with, or connected to, or part of each individual electron that is affected by both slits. But what could that something be? Quantum waves. For a clue as to how an electron traveling through one slit knows about the other, let's look more closely at the data. The light-dark pattern is as recognizable to a physicist as a mother's face is to her baby. The pattern says, no, it screams, waves. If you've ever dropped two pebbles into a pond and watched as the resulting ripples spread and overlap, you know what I mean. Where the peak of one wave crosses the peak of another, the combined wave height is big. Where the trough of one crosses the trough of another, the combined wave depression is deep. And most important of all, where the peak of one crosses the trough of the other, the waves cancel and the water remains level. If you were to insert a detector screen that recorded the water's agitation at each location, the larger the agitation, the brighter the reading, the result would be a series of alternating bright and dark regions on the screen. Bright regions would be where the waves reinforce each other, yielding much agitation. Dark regions would be where the waves cancel, yielding no agitation. This is to say the overlapping waves interfere with one another and call the bright, dark, bright data that they produce an interference pattern. The similarity to the data from the quantum double slit experiment is unmistakable. So in trying to explain the electron data, we're led to think about waves. Good, that's a start. But the details are still murky. What kind of waves? Where are they? And what have they to do with particles such as electrons? The next clue comes from the experimental fact I emphasized at the outset. Reams of data on the motion of particles show that regularities emerge only statistically. The same measurements performed on identically prepared particles will generally reveal them to be in different places. Yet many such measurements establish that, on average, the particles have the same probability of being found at any given location. In 1926, the German physicist Max Born joined these two clues together and with them made a leap that nearly three decades later would earn him a Nobel Prize. You've got experimental evidence that waves play a role. You've got experimental evidence that probabilities play a role. Perhaps, Born suggested, the wave associated with the particle is a probability wave. It was an unprecedented and spectacularly original contribution. The idea is that in analyzing the motion of a particle, we shouldn't think of it as a rock hurtling from here to there. Instead, we should think of it as a wave undulating from here to there. Locations where the wave's values are large, near its peaks and troughs, are locations where the particle is likely to be found. Locations where the probability wave's values are small are locations where the particle is unlikely to be found. Locations where the wave's values vanish are places where the particle won't be found. As the wave rolls onward, the values evolve, going up in some locations, down in others. And since we're interpreting the undulating values as undulating probabilities, the wave is justly called a probability wave. To flesh out the picture, consider how it explains the double slit data. As an electron travels toward the barrier, quantum mechanics tells us to think of it as an undulating wave. When the wave encounters the barrier, two wave fragments make it through the slits and undulate onward toward the detector screen. What happens next is key. Much like overlapping water waves, the probability waves emerging from the two slits overlap and interfere, yielding a combined form that looks very much like the interference pattern, a pattern of high and low values that, according to quantum mechanics, corresponds with a pattern of high and low probabilities for where the electron will land. When electron after electron is fired, the cumulative landing positions conform to this probability profile. Many electrons land where the probability is high, few where it's low, and none where the probability vanishes. The result is the series of bright and dark bands found initially in the work of Davison and Germer. And that's how quantum theory explains the data. The description makes manifest that each electron does know about both slits, since each electron's probability wave passes through both. It's the union of these two partial waves that dictates the probabilities for where the electrons land. That's why the mere presence of a second slit affects the results. Not so fast. Although I focused on electrons, Similar experiments have established the same probability wave picture for all of nature's basic constituents. Photons, neutrinos, muons, quarks, every fundamental particle, all are described by waves of probability. But before we declare victory, three questions immediately present themselves. Two are straightforward, one is a bear. It's the latter that Everett sought to answer back in the 1950s, and it led him to a quantum version of parallel worlds. First, if quantum theory is right, and the world unfolds probabilistically, why is Newton's non-probabilistic framework so good at predicting the motion of things from baseballs to planets to stars? The answer is that probability waves for big things usually, but not always, as we will shortly see, have a very particular shape. They're extraordinarily narrow, meaning there's a huge probability, just shy of 100%, that the object is located where the wave is peaked, and a minuscule probability, just a shade above 0%, that it's located anywhere else. Moreover, the quantum laws show that the peaks of such narrow waves move along the very same trajectories that emerge from Newton's equations. And so, while Newton's laws predict precisely the trajectory of a baseball, quantum theory offers only the most minimal refinement, saying there's a nearly 100% probability that the ball will land where Newton says it should, and a nearly 0% probability that it won't. In fact, the words just shy and nearly don't do the physics justice. The chance of a macroscopic body deviating from Newton's predictions is so fantastically tiny that if you'd been keeping tabs on the cosmos for the last few billion years, the odds are overwhelming that you'd have never seen it happen. But according to quantum theory, the smaller an object is, the more spread out its probability wave typically is. This implies substantial probabilities of the electron being at a variety of locations, a totally foreign concept in a Newtonian world. And that's why it's the microrealm where the probabilistic nature of reality comes to the fore. Second, can we see the probability waves on which quantum mechanics relies? Is there any way to directly access the unfamiliar probabilistic haze in which a single particle has a chance of being found in a variety of locations? No. The standard approach to quantum mechanics, developed by Bohr and his group, and called the Copenhagen interpretation in their honor, envisions that whenever you try to see a probability wave, the very act of observation thwarts your attempt. When you look at an electron's probability wave, where look means measure its position, the electron responds by snapping to attention and coalescing at one definite location. Correspondingly, the probability wave surges to 100% at that spot while collapsing to 0% everywhere else. Look away, and the needle-thin probability wave rapidly spreads, indicating that, once again, there's a reasonable chance of finding the electron at a variety of locations. Look back, and the electron's wave collapses anew, eliminating the range of possible places the electron might be found in favor of its occupying a single, definite spot. In short, every time you attempt to see the probabilistic haze, it disappears. It collapses and is supplanted by familiar reality. The detector screen in the double slit experiment provides a case in point. It measures the impinging probability wave of an electron and thus immediately causes it to collapse. The detector forces the electron to relinquish the many available options for where it could hit and settle upon a definite landing location, which is then evidenced by a tiny dot on the screen. I understand full well if this explanation leaves you shaking your head. There's no denying that quantum dogma sounds a lot like snake oil. I mean, along comes a theory that proposes a startling new picture of reality founded on waves of probability, and then, in the very next breath, announces that the waves can't be seen. Imagine Lucille claiming she's a blonde until someone looks, when she immediately transforms into a redhead. Why would physicists accept an approach that's not only strange, but that seems so downright slippery. Fortunately, for all its mysterious and hidden features, quantum mechanics is testable. According to the Copenhagenists, the larger a probability wave is at a particular location, the greater the chance that when the wave collapses, its sole remaining spike, and hence the electron itself, will be situated there. That statement yields predictions. Run a given experiment over and over again, count how often you find the particle at various locations, and assess whether the frequencies you observe agree with the probabilities dictated by the probability wave. If the wave is 2.874 times as big here as it is there, do you find the particle here 2.874 times as often as you find it there? Predictions like these have been enormously successful. Widely as the quantum perspective may seem, it's hard to argue with such phenomenal results. But not impossible. Which takes us to the third and most difficult question. The collapsing of probability waves upon measurement is a centerpiece of the Copenhagen approach to quantum theory. The confluence of its successful predictions and Bohr's forceful proselytizing led most physicists to accept it. But even polite prodding quickly reveals an uncomfortable feature. Schrödinger's equation, the mathematical engine of quantum mechanics, dictates how the shape of a probability wave evolves in time. Give me an initial wave shape, and I can use Schrödinger's equation to draw a picture of what the wave will look like in a minute, or an hour, or at any other moment. But straightforward analysis of the equation reveals that the evolution proposed to accompany a measurement, the instantaneous collapse of a wave at all but one point, like a lone parishioner in a megachurch accidentally standing while everyone else kneels, can't possibly emerge from Schrödinger's math. Waves surely can have a needle-thin spiked shape. We'll make ample use of some spike waves shortly. But they can't become spiked in the manner envisioned by the Copenhagen approach. The math simply doesn't allow it. We'll see why in a moment. Bohr advanced a heavy-handed remedy. Evolve probability waves according to Schrödinger's equation whenever you're not looking or performing any kind of measurement. But when you do look, Bohr continued, you should throw Schrödinger's equation aside and declare that your observation has caused the wave to collapse. Now, not only is this prescription ungainly, not only is it arbitrary, not only does it lack a mathematical underpinning, it's not even clear. For instance, it doesn't precisely define looking or measuring. Must a human be involved? Or, as Einstein once asked, will a sidelong glance from a mouse suffice? How about a computer's probe or even a nudge from a bacterium or virus? Do these measurements cause probability waves to collapse? Bohr announced that he was drawing a line in the sand, separating small things, such as atoms and their constituents, to which Schrödinger's equation would apply, and big things, such as experimenters and their equipment, to which it wouldn't. But he never said where exactly that line would be. The reality is, he couldn't. With each passing year, experimenters confirm that Schrödinger's equation works without modification for increasingly large collections of particles, and there's every reason to believe that it works for collections as hefty as those making up you and me and everything else. Like floodwater slowly rising from your basement, rushing into your living room, and threatening to engulf your attic, the mathematics of quantum mechanics has steadily spilled beyond the atomic domain and has succeeded on ever larger scales. So, the way to think about the problem is this. You and I and computers and bacteria and viruses and everything else material are made of molecules and atoms, which are themselves composed of particles like electrons and quarks. Schrödinger's equation works for electrons and quarks, and all evidence points to its working for things made of these constituents, regardless of the number of particles involved. This means that Schrödinger's equation should continue to apply during a measurement. After all, a measurement is just one collection of particles, the person, the equipment, the computer, coming into contact with another, the particle or particles being measured. But if that's the case, if Schrödinger's math refuses to bow down, then Bohr is in trouble. Schrödinger's equation doesn't allow waves to collapse. An essential element of the Copenhagen approach would therefore be undermined. So the third question is this. If the reasoning just recounted is right, and probability waves don't collapse, how do we pass from the range of possible outcomes that exist before a measurement to the single outcome the measurement reveals? Or, to put it in more general terms, what happens to a probability wave during a measurement that allows a familiar, definite, unique reality to take hold? Everett pursued this question in his Princeton doctoral dissertation and came to an unforeseen conclusion. Linearity and its discontents. To understand Everett's path of discovery, you need to know a little more about Schrödinger's equation. I've emphasized that it doesn't allow probability waves to suddenly collapse, but why not? And what does it allow? Let's get a feel for how Schrödinger's math guides a probability wave as it evolves through time. This is fairly straightforward because Schrödinger's is one of the simplest kinds of mathematical equations characterized by a property known as linearity, a mathematical embodiment of the whole being the sum of its parts. Linearity is an extraordinarily powerful mathematical feature. It allows for an all-important divide-and-conquer strategy. If an initial wave shape is complicated, you are free to divide it up into simpler pieces and analyze each separately. At the end, you just put the individual results back together. We've actually already seen an important application of linearity through our analysis of the double-slit experiment. To determine how the electron's probability wave evolves, we divided the task. We noted how the piece passing through the left slit evolves. We noted how the piece passing through the right slit evolves. And we then added the two waves together. That's how we found the famous interference pattern. Look at a quantum theorist blackboard, and it is this very approach you'll see underlying a great many of the mathematical manipulations. But linearity not only makes quantum calculations manageable, it's also at the heart of the theory's difficulty in explaining what happens during a measurement. This is best understood by applying linearity to the act of measurement itself. Imagine you're an experimentalist with great nostalgia for your childhood in New York. So you're measuring the positions of electrons that you inject into a miniature tabletop model of the city. You start your experiments with one electron whose probability wave has a particularly simple shape. It's nice and spiked, indicating that with essentially 100% probability, the electron is momentarily sitting at the corner of 34th Street and Broadway. Don't worry about how the electron got this wave shape, just take it as a given. If at that very moment you measure the electron's position with a well-made piece of equipment, the results should be accurate. The device's readout should say 34th Street and Broadway. Indeed, if you do this experiment, that's just what happens. It would be extraordinarily complicated to work out how Schrödinger's equation entwines the probability wave of the electron with that of the trillion or so atoms that make up the measuring device, coaxing a collection of the latter to arrange themselves in the readout to spell 34th Street and Broadway. But whoever designed the device has done the heavy lifting for us. It's been engineered so that its interaction with such an electron causes the readout to display the single definite position where, at that moment, the electron is located. If the device did anything else in this situation, we'd be wise to exchange it for a new one that functions properly. And of course, Macy's notwithstanding, there's nothing special about 34th and Broadway. If we do the same experiment with the electron's probability wave spiked at the Hayden Planetarium near 81st and Central Park West, or at Bill Clinton's office at 125th near Lenox Avenue, the device's readout will return these locations. Let's now consider a slightly more complicated wave shape, a shape that has two spikes, indicating that there are two places the electron might be found, say, Strawberry Fields, the John Lennon Memorial in Central Park, and Grant's Tomb in Riverside Park, the electron's in one of its dark moods. If we measure the electron's position, but in opposition to Bohr, and in keeping with the most refined experiments, assume that Schrödinger's equation continues to apply to the electron, to the particles in the measuring device, to everything, what will the device's output read? Linearity is the key to the answer. We know what happens when we measure spiked waves individually. Schrödinger's equation causes the device's display to spell out the spike's location. Linearity then tells us that to find the answer for two spikes, we combine the results of measuring each spike separately. Here's where things get weird. At first blush, the combined results suggest that the display should simultaneously register the locations of both spikes. The words Strawberry Fields and Grant's Tomb should flash simultaneously, one location commingled with the other, like the confused monitor of a computer that's about to crash. Schrödinger's equation also dictates how the probability waves of the photons emitted by the measuring device's display entangle with those of the particles in your rods and cones, and subsequently those rushing through your neurons, creating a mental state reflecting what you see. Assuming unlimited Schrödinger hegemony, linearity applies here too. So not only will the device simultaneously display both locations, but also your brain will be caught up in the confusion, thinking that the electron is simultaneously positioned at both. For yet more complicated wave shapes, the confusion becomes yet wilder. A shape with four spikes doubles the dizziness. With six, it triples. Notice that if you keep on going, putting wave spikes of various heights at every location in the model Manhattan, their combined shape fills out an ordinary, more gradually varying quantum wave shape. Linearity still holds, and this implies that the final device reading in this case, as well as your final brain state and mental impression, are dictated by the union of the results for each spike individually. The device should simultaneously register the location of each and every spike, each and every location in Manhattan, as your mind becomes profoundly puzzled, being unable to settle on a single, definite location for the electron. But of course, this seems grossly at odds with experience. No properly functioning device, when taking a measurement, displays conflicting results. No properly functioning person, on performing a measurement, has the mental impression of a dizzying melange of simultaneous yet distinct outcomes. You can now see the appeal of Bohr's prescription. "Hold the Dramamine," he'd declare. According to Bohr, we don't see ambiguous meter readings because they don't happen. He'd argue that we've come to an incorrect conclusion because we've overextended the reach of Schrödinger's equation into the domain of big things, laboratory equipment that takes measurements, and scientists who read the results. Although Schrödinger's equation and its feature of linearity dictate that we should combine the results from distinct possible outcomes, nothing collapses. Bohr tells us that this is wrong because the act of measurement tosses Schrödinger's math out the window. Instead, he'd pronounce, the measurement causes all but one of the spikes constituting a quantum wave to collapse to zero. The probability that a particular spike will be the sole survivor is proportional to the spike's height. That unique remaining spike determines the device's unique reading, as well as your mind's recognition of a unique result. Dizziness, done. But for Everett and later DeWitt, the cost of Bohr's approach was too high. Schrödinger's equation is meant to describe particles, all particles. Why would it somehow not apply to particular configurations of particles? those constituting the equipment that takes measurements, and those in the experimenters who monitor the equipment. This just didn't make sense. Everett therefore suggested that we not dispense with Schrödinger so quickly. Instead, he advocated that we analyze where Schrödinger's equation takes us from a decidedly different perspective. Many worlds. The challenge we've encountered is that it's bewildering to think of a measuring device, or a mind, as simultaneously experiencing distinct realities. We can have conflicting opinions on this or that issue, mixed emotions regarding this or that person. But when it comes to the facts that constitute reality, everything we know attests to there being an unambiguous objective description. Everything we know attests that one device and one measurement will yield one reading. One reading and one mind will yield one mental impression. Everett's idea was that Schrödinger's math, the core of quantum mechanics, is compatible with such basic experiences. The source of the supposed ambiguity in device readings and mental impressions is the manner in which we've executed that math. The manner, that is, in which we've combined the results of the simplest measurements, measurements of probability waves shaped as individual spikes. Let's think it through. When you measure a single spiked wave, the device registers the spike's location. If it's spiked at Strawberry Fields, that's what the device reads. If you look at the result, your brain registers that location and you become aware of it. If it's spiked at Grant's Tomb, that's what the device registers. If you look, your brain registers that location and you become aware of it. When you measure a double spiked wave, Schrödinger's math tells you to combine the two results you just found. But, says Everett, be careful and precise when you combine them. The combined result, he argued, does not yield a meter and a mind, each simultaneously registering two locations. That's sloppy thinking. Instead, proceeding slowly and literally, we find that the combined result is a device and a mind registering Strawberry Fields, and a device and a mind registering Grant's Tomb. And what does that mean? I'll use broad strokes in painting the general picture, which I'll refine shortly. To accommodate Everett's suggested outcome, the device and you and everything else must split upon measurement, yielding two devices, two yous, and two everything else's. The only difference between the two being that one device and one you registers Strawberry Fields, while the other device and the other you registers Grant's Tomb. This implies that we now have two parallel realities, two parallel worlds. To the you occupying each, the measurement and your mental impression of the result are sharp and unique and thus feel like life as usual. The peculiarity, of course, is that there are two of you who feel this way. To keep the discussion accessible, I focused on the position measurement of a single particle and one that has a particularly simple probability wave. But Everett's proposal applies generally. If you measured the position of a particle whose probability wave has any number of spikes, say 5, the result, according to Everett, would be 5 parallel realities differing only by the location registered on each reality's device and within the mind of each reality's you. If one of these yous then measured the position of another particle whose wave had 7 spikes, that you and that world would split again into 7 more, one for each possible outcome. And if you measured a wave that is spread out over Manhattan, which can be partitioned into a great many tightly packed spikes, the result would be a great many parallel realities in which each possible particle location would be recorded on a device and read by a copy of you. In Everett's approach, everything that is possible, quantum mechanically speaking, that is, all those outcomes to which quantum mechanics assigns a non-zero probability, is realized in its own separate world. These are the many worlds of the many worlds approach to quantum mechanics. If we apply the terminology we've been using in earlier chapters, these many worlds would properly be described as many universes composing a multiverse, the sixth we've encountered. I'll call it the quantum multiverse. A Tale of Two Tales. In describing how quantum mechanics may generate many realities, I used the word split. Everett used it, so did DeWitt. Nevertheless, in this context, it's a loaded verb with the potential to grossly mislead, and I'd intended not to invoke it. But I gave in to temptation. In my defense, it's sometimes more effective to use a sledgehammer to break down a barrier separating us from an unfamiliar proposal about the workings of reality and to subsequently repair the damage than it is to delicately carve a pristine window that directly reveals the new vista. I've been using that sledgehammer. In this and the next section, I'll undertake the necessary repairs. Some of the ideas are a touch more difficult than those we've so far encountered, and the explanatory chains are a bit longer as well. But I encourage you to stay with me. I found that all too often, people who learn about, or are even somewhat familiar with, the many worlds idea have the impression that it emerged from speculation of the most extravagant sort. But nothing could be further from the truth. As I will explain, the many worlds approach is in some ways the most conservative framework for defining quantum physics, and it's important to understand why. The essential point is that physicists must always tell two kinds of stories. One is the mathematical story of how the universe evolves according to a given theory. The other, also essential, is the physical story, which translates the abstract mathematics into experiential language. This second story describes how the mathematical evolution will appear to observers like you and me, and more generally, what the theory's mathematical symbols tell us about the nature of reality. In the time of Newton, the two stories were essentially identical, as I suggested with my remarks in Chapter 7 about Newtonian architecture being immediate and palpable. Every mathematical symbol in Newton's equations has a direct and transparent physical correlate. The symbol X, oh, that's the ball's position. The symbol V, the ball's velocity. By the time we get to quantum mechanics, however, translation between the mathematical symbols and what we can see in the world around us becomes far more subtle. In turn, the language used and the concepts deemed relevant to each of the two stories become so different that you need both to acquire a full understanding. But it's important to keep straight which story is which, to understand fully which ideas and descriptions are invoked as part of the theory's fundamental mathematical structure, and which are used to build a bridge to human experience. Let's tell the two stories for the many worlds approach to quantum mechanics. Here's the first. The mathematics of many worlds, unlike that of Copenhagen, is pure, simple, and constant. Schrödinger's equation determines how probability waves evolve over time, and it is never set aside. It is always in effect. Schrödinger's math guides the shape of probability waves, causing them to shift, morph, and undulate over time. Whether it's addressing the probability wave for a particle, or for a collection of particles, or for the various assemblages of particles that constitute you and your measuring equipment, Schrödinger's equation takes the particle's initial probability wave shape as input, and then, like the graphics program driving an elaborate screensaver, provides the wave shape at any future time as output. And that, according to this approach, is how the universe evolves. Period. End of story. Or, more precisely, end of first story. Notice that in telling the first story, I did not need the word split, nor the terms many worlds, parallel universes, or quantum multiverse. The many worlds approach does not hypothesize these features. They play no role in the theory's fundamental mathematical structure. Rather, as we will now see, these ideas are called upon in the theory's second story, when, following Everett and others who've since extended his pioneering work, we investigate what the mathematics tells us about our observations and our measurements. Let's start simply, or at least as simply as we can. Consider again measuring an electron that has a spiked probability wave, with the spike's location being 34th Street and Broadway. Again, don't worry about how it got this wave shape, just take it as a given. As noted earlier, to tell the first story of even this measurement process in detail is beyond what we can do. We'd need to use Schrödinger's math to figure out how the probability wave describing the positions of the huge number of particles that constitute you and your measuring device joins with the probability wave of the electron and how their union evolves forward in time. My undergraduate students, many of whom are quite able, often struggle to solve Schrödinger's equation for even a single particle. Between you and the device, there are something like 10 to the 27 particles. Working out Schrödinger's math for that many constituents is virtually impossible. Even so, we understand qualitatively what the math entails. When we measure the electron's position, we cause a mass particle migration. Some 10 to the 24 or so particles in the device's display, like performers in a crisply choreographed halftime show, race to the appropriate spot so that they collectively spell out 34th Street and Broadway, while a similar number, in my eyes and brain, do whatever's required for me to develop a firm mental grasp of the result. Schrödinger's math, however impenetrable explicit analysis of it might be when faced with so many particles, describes such a particle shift. To fully visualize this transformation at the level of a probability wave is also far beyond reach. In describing the probability wave for a single electron, I've implicitly been using two axes to specify the particle's position, the north-south and east-west street grid of our model Manhattan, and have been imagining that the probability wave's value at any particular location was denoted by the wave's height. This already simplifies things because I've left out the third axis, the particle's vertical position, whether it's on the second floor of Macy's or the fifth. Including the vertical would have been awkward because if I'd used it to denote position, I'd have no axis left for recording the size of the wave. Such are the limitations of a brain and a visual system that evolution has firmly rooted in three spatial dimensions. To properly visualize the probability wave for roughly 10 to the 27 particles, I'd need to include three axes for each, allowing me to account mathematically for every possible position each particle could occupy. Adding even a single vertical axis to our description of a single particle would have made it difficult to visualize that. To contemplate adding a billion, billion, billion more is, well, silly. But a mental image of the key ideas is important. So however imperfect the result, let's give it a try. In describing the probability wave for all the particles making up you and your device, I'll use the single particle template with two axes, but will invoke an unconventional interpretation of what the axes mean. Roughly speaking, I'll think of each axis as comprising an enormous bundle of axes, tightly grouped together, which will symbolically delineate the possible positions of a similarly enormous number of particles. A wave drawn using these bundled axes will therefore lay out the probabilities for the positions of a huge group of particles. The many-particle and single-particle waves have some features in common. Just as a spiked wave shape for a single electron indicates probabilities that are sharply skewed, being almost 100% at the spike's location and almost 0% everywhere else, so a peaked wave describing many particles also denotes sharply skewed probabilities. But you need to exercise care because understanding based on the single particle imagery can only take you so far. For example, it's natural to think that a spiked many particle wave represents particles that are all clustered around the same location. Yet that's not right. Such a peaked shape symbolizes that each of the particles making up you and each of the particles making up the device starts out in the ordinary, familiar state of having a position that is nearly 100% definite. But they are not all positioned at the same location. The particles constituting your hand, shoulder, and brain are, with near certainty, clustered within the location of your hand, shoulder, and brain. The particles constituting the measuring device are, with near certainty, clustered within the location of the device. A peaked wave shape means that each of these particles has only the most remote chance of being found anywhere else. If you now perform a position measurement of an electron whose probability wave is spiked at Strawberry Fields, the many-particle probability wave for the particles inside you and the device, by virtue of the interaction with the electron, evolves. All the particles involved still have nearly definite positions within you and within the device, and so the many-particle wave maintains a spiked shape. But a mass particle rearrangement occurs that results in the words Strawberry Fields forming in the device's readout and also in your brain. This rearrangement is reflected mathematically by the many-particle wave describing the particles in you and in the device, shifting its overall position. A mathematical transformation dictated by Schrödinger's equation. And that's the first kind of story. The device's readout, displaying Strawberry Fields, and your recognition of this result constitute the physical description of such mathematical evolution, and that's the second kind of story. Similarly, if we perform the same experiment, but with the electron's probability wave spiked at Grant's tomb, an analogous wave shift dictated by Schrödinger's equation takes place, the first kind of story. This shift corresponds to a different mass particle rearrangement, one that spells out Grant's tomb in the display and generates within you the associated mental impression, the second kind of story. Now use linearity to put the two together. If you measure the position of an electron whose probability wave is spiked at two locations, the probability wave for you and your device commingles with that of the electron, resulting in a many-particle wave evolution, which is a combination of the shifts associated with each spike individually. The many-particle wave, again for the particles in you and in the device, shifts partly one way and partly another, yielding two spikes in the many-particle probability wave. So far, this is nothing but an illustrated and annotated version of the first type of quantum story. We start with a many-particle probability wave of a given shape, Schrödinger's equation evolves it forward in time, and we end up with a many-particle probability wave of a new shape. But the details we've overlaid now let us tell this mathematical story in more qualitative type 2 story language. Physically, each spike in the many-particle probability wave represents a configuration of an enormous number of particles that results in a device having a particular reading and your mind acquiring that information. In one spike, the reading is Strawberry Fields. In the other, it's Grant's tomb. Besides that difference, nothing distinguishes one spike from the other. I emphasize this because it's essential to realize that neither is somehow more real than the other. Nothing but the device's particular reading and your reading of that reading distinguishes the two spikes in the multi-particle wave, which means our type 2 story involves two realities. In fact, the focus on the device and your mind is merely another simplification. I could have also included the particles that make up the laboratory and everything therein, as well as those of the Earth, the Sun, and so on, and the whole discussion would have been the same, essentially verbatim. The only difference would have been that the many-particle probability wave would now have information about all those particles, too. But because the measurement we're discussing has a